All set, he said. Would you like a preview? Kessler stepped aside, allowing Andy to enter first. She was immediately struck by the cold and the lights. Autopsy rooms were like walking into Antarctica, bright and frigid. The body lay in the center of the room atop a stainless steel examining table. One leg, most of the torso, and the left side of the face were covered with white cloth, which didn't strike Andy as standard procedure. Dr. Fitzsimmons explained, I've covered the more gruesome wounds for Mr. Wheatley's benefit. No need to show a man which parts of his wife are now nourishing the wildlife at Washington Park. Andy asked, Do we have to bring the poor man right into the autopsy room to make the identification? It's hard enough to see a loved one pulled out of a drawer in the morgue.
Ordinarily, I wouldn't do this, said Kessler. But I don't want to lose any more time in this case. I've asked Dr. Fitzsimmons to be prepared to proceed with the autopsy just as soon as Mr. Wheatley makes the identification.
If we could just wait 12 hours, said Andy, I think we would all benefit from Agent Santos's examination of the body before autopsy.
Kessler paused, thinking. Well, perhaps we could postpone some of the more invasive procedures. But I would at least like Dr. Fitzsimmons to proceed far enough to rule out suicide. If we're going to explore the possibility of a serial killer, we might as well know if this woman was in fact the victim of a homicide.
I can answer that question right now, said the doctor.
Kessler looked at him curiously.
How? Look here.
He shined a spotlight on the side of the victim's neck. Both Andy and the detective walked toward the head of the table for a closer look.
See the narrow bruise around the neck? Asked the doctor. It's a straight line all the way around, matching the pressure of the rope. Those markings indicate strangulation by ligature. With a hanging, you typically have a very well-defined, inverted V-shaped bruise. Think of the way the noose fits around the neck.
Kessler said, But she was found hanging in a tree. Why no inverted V bruise?
Bruising requires blood flow, said Andy.
That's exactly right. The doctor seemed impressed.
Andy leaned over, inspecting the neck. Doctor, are you saying she was dead before her body was strung up?
Yes. Strangled, to be precise.
So we're not talking suicide, said Kessler.
Dr. Fitzsimmons shook his head.
More likely homicide.
Kessler nodded.
Committed by someone who wanted it to look like suicide.
Possibly.
Andy rose, chilled by her thoughts.
Or by someone who delights in displaying his kill.
Gus's Mercedes cut across Seattle in record time. The attendant greeted him at the door and took him down the hall that led to the autopsy room. Gus had been expecting to go to the morgue and have his wife rolled out of a drawer, like on television. Lately, nothing had been going according to his expectations.
Please wait here, said the attendant as they reached the waiting room.
Gus sat alone on one of two Naugahyde chairs that shared a vintage 70s smoked glass coffee table. The lighting was bad fluorescent, the kind that bothered the eyes. Gus had never practiced criminal law, but suddenly he had an appreciation for the stakes, the drama. He felt as though someone in the next room literally had life or death power over him. Yet it wasn't as if the medical examiner had a juror's prerogative to change the outcome. Either it was Beth or it wasn't. He'd know in a minute. His mind flooded with fond thoughts for his wife. The romantic dinners in San Francisco while he was in law school. The weekend hikes around Mount Rainier when they'd first moved to Seattle. Their honeymoon in Hawaii, cut short by a phone call from Gus's supervising partner. The birth of their daughter, which had come 2 weeks early while Gus was in Hong Kong, and yet another business trip that Beth had begged him not to take. They'd loved each other once, though he couldn't put his finger on the exact sad moment when she'd realized that he loved his job more.
Mr. Wheatley?
He rose eagerly. I'm Andy Henning, FBI. He stepped forward and shook her hand. What's the FBI doing here?
I'd like you to come inside and make the identification, if you can. I should warn you, the body is not in perfect condition. We've prepared it so that when Dr. Fitzsimmons pulls back the sheet, You'll see only the right side of the head and face. I think that should be enough.
Gus felt a lump in his throat.
Okay, let's do it.
Andy led him inside. Gus felt a definite chill in his face and hands, but the change in room temperature barely fazed him. He entered slowly, one step at a time, eyes fixed ahead on the stainless steel table in the center of the room. Beneath the bright lights, a clean white sheet covered the body. It seemed to rise for one breast, but not for the other. Likewise with the feet. His hands shook. That must have been what Agent Henning had meant when she'd said the body wasn't perfect. He stopped beside the autopsy table. Andy was to his right. Detective Kessler stood on the other side beside Dr. Fitzsimmons.
"Are you ready, Mr. Wheatley?"
asked Andy. He blinked nervously, then nodded. Dr. Fitzsimmons pulled back the sheet, exposing the head. Gus's eyes filled with tears. He could barely speak.
"It's not Beth,"
he said, then quickly turned away.
This ends Disc 1, Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 2.
Chapter 6. Andy watched from behind as Gus headed for the door. The transformation had been sudden and remarkable. One moment, a bundle of nerves bouncing off the walls, the next, a beaten man sinking through the floor. For friends and relatives, accounting for a missing loved one was always the same painful roller coaster. It certainly put a screwed-up wedding in perspective.
"Mr. Wheatley,"
she said as Gus opened the door. He stopped in the doorway.
"Yes? Would you mind waiting in the lobby for a few minutes? Detective Kessler and I will be right with you."
He hesitated. "I'd really just like to pick up my daughter and go home."
"Just 5 minutes. Promise."
Gus nodded, then left the room. Detective Kessler looked at her quizzically from across the table.
"Just let the guy go. I can do the paperwork later."
"This isn't about paperwork. I have some things I'd like to ask him about his wife."
"Now? Why?"
"I don't want to speak out of turn," said Andy. "Agent Santos is the expert, and she'll give us her views tomorrow. But just look at what you've got so far. 3 homicide victims, all strangled with evidence of overkill. The first two are like a pair, almost identical. The third is a woman in her mid-30s.
She glanced at the body before her. "If you look at the state of decomposition, I think we all suspected this wasn't Beth Wheatley. As I'm sure Dr. Fitzsimmons will attest, it's not easy to pinpoint the time of death on a body that has been exposed to animals and the elements. But if I had to guess, I'd say this woman was dead before Beth Wheatley disappeared on Sunday."
"Probably a fair assumption," said the doctor.
"So?"
asked Kessler. Andy continued. "We may be dealing with, I don't know what you'd call them, bookend homicides. The first two are men who match each other, like bookends. The third is a woman who has nothing in common with the men other than the strangulation and overkill. But she does happen to bear a physical resemblance to Beth Wheatley, who disappeared yesterday."
"You're thinking Beth Wheatley is this woman's bookend, as you call it?"
"I'm saying it's possible. That's why we need to find out more about Mrs. Wheatley, her daily routine, her lifestyle, as much as we can learn. Once we have a better understanding of who Beth Wheatley is," she said, glancing at the body, "I think we'll have a much easier time figuring out who this is."
Kessler scratched his head, mulling it over.
"Sounds like the kind of thing an FBI agent would come up with."
"What do you mean by that?"
"Nothing. If you want to ask Wheatley some questions, be my guest. But excuse me if I don't jump in with both feet."
His cynicism was annoying, but as she started toward the door, she could think only of the beleaguered man in the waiting room. She stopped for a moment and looked Kessler in the eye.
"You know, Dick, I hope you're right. I hope my bookend theory is full of shit. Because if it's not, this is one hell of a good news, bad news scenario."
Kessler got her drift.
"Good news, Mr. Wheatley. That's not your wife stretched out on the table.
But the bad news is, it probably will be.
She opened the door, and they entered the waiting room. She decided to interview him right where he was, in the waiting room. It was private enough and would feel less like an interrogation. Andy was big on not making victims feel like suspects. Gus remained seated on the couch. Andy and Kessler pulled up chairs facing him. Andy spared him the bookend theory. His nightmare was bad enough already. No need to subject him to police speculation about a serial killer who likes his victims in matching pairs.
"Mr. Wheatley," she said softly, "I'd like to get some information from you about your wife. Not the height, weight, and hair color things, some personal things."
"How personal?"
"Nothing embarrassing. If I get too nosy, you don't have to answer. Let's start general. Does your wife work outside the home?"
"No."
"What is her daily routine like?"
Gus shrugged awkwardly. "I guess it depends on the day."
"Let's take them one at a time. Monday.
She takes our daughter to school in the morning."
"What else?"
"She picks her up."
She smiled, trying to put him at ease.
"Quite a gap there.
How does she fill her day?"
"On Mondays, you mean?"
"Let's not get hung up on specific days here. I want to make this easy for you. Pick any day of the week you like. Just tell me what kinds of things she does with her time."
"I check with the credit card companies to piece together this last weekend, just to see where she'd charge things. But I can't say as a general matter I know every little thing she does on a typical day."
"Well, does your wife belong to any kind of clubs or organizations?"
"I think she's in something. No, that was before Morgan was born."
Andy glanced at Kessler, then back at Gus.
"How about lunches? Does she have a favorite restaurant?" "I'd imagine she does."
He paused, as if drawing a blank.
"But I can't say she ever mentioned it. Maybe if I went back to the credit card statement, I could figure it out."
"What about food shopping? Where did she go to buy groceries?"
Gus said nothing.
"Does she belong to a gym?"
"Yes,"
he said emphatically, pleased to have hit one.
"Which one?"
His enthusiasm faded.
"I'll have to check."
Andy hesitated before asking the next question. The silence seemed to make him uncomfortable. Kessler leaned forward, arching an eyebrow.
"Mr. Wheatley, are you and your wife happily married?"
"What does that have to do with anything?"
"You seem to know very little about the woman who sleeps beside you."
"Is that what this inquisition is all about? You still think this has something to do with a marital quarrel?"
Kessler gave an assessing look. "I'm not ruling anything out."
"Well, you'd better rule it out. Are you going to piss away valuable time?" "Please," said Andy, "don't get angry."
"I have every right to be angry. So what if I don't know every little detail about my wife's daily routine? That doesn't mean I don't care what happens to her."
"You're absolutely right," she said.
"Then why are you putting me through this?"
Andy started to say something, then stopped. It was premature to tell him his wife might be a bookend homicide, and this inquiry was going nowhere. "I'm sorry, Mr. Wheatley. It's late, and you've been through an awful lot for one night. Go home to your daughter. I'm sure she needs all the support you can give her."
"And then some,"
he said, seemingly overwhelmed.
Kessler pressed on, as if Gus's lousy answers had suddenly fueled his interest. "Mr. Wheatley, is there someone else who could answer these questions for us?"
"Probably my sister, Carla. She was Beth's best friend before we got married. My biggest enemy after we got married."
"What do you mean by that?"
Nothing. I'm exaggerating. Let's just say Carla's always been a lot closer to Beth than she ever was to me."
"Anyone else?"
"My daughter, of course. But she's only 6. I'd rather keep her out of this." Andy said, "We'll handle her appropriately when and if the time comes."
"Your wife's mother and father live anywhere nearby?"
asked Kessler.
"They're both deceased.
You have a housekeeper?
We have a woman who comes in twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays. She just does her work and leaves.
What's her name?
Jeez. Ramona something. I don't know her last name.
What about a nanny?
We had one till recently. Michelle Burgett.
What happened?
Beth let her go when Morgan started first grade. Didn't need to live in anymore.
You know where she is now?
No idea.
Kessler raised an eyebrow.
She raises your kid for 6 years, then that's it? Cold turkey? No contact?
Look, I don't know. Maybe they've talked on the phone. For all I know, she's even come by to visit. Beth would have taken care of all that.
Kessler jotted down a note to himself.
You mind if I talk to any of these people, Mr. Wheatley?
Why would I mind?
You tell me,
he said, his eyes narrowing. He was clearly trying to intimidate.
Gus rose, speaking with controlled anger.
I really don't like the way I'm being interrogated here. I don't really like the answers I'm getting.
Andy stepped between them.
Okay, boys, let's call it a night.
Gus glared, then looked away. He shook Andy's hand.
Thank you, he said, looking only at her. You've been nice. Please call me as soon as you hear anything.
We will, she said, seeing him out.
As the door shut behind him, she faced Kessler and said,
Are you always so confrontational?
Only when the subject is evasive.
I didn't think he was being evasive.
I see it all the time. These smart-ass attorneys who think the only safe thing to tell a cop is either, I don't know, or he went that away. You can't get a straight answer out of a guy like that.
He wasn't playing games. Didn't you see the embarrassment in his eyes? The pain in his expression?
Give me a break. I'm not the world's greatest husband. I bet I even work longer hours than he does. But even I know where my wife buys groceries.
Is that so? She said, toying with him. Where?
His mouth opened, but the words stumbled out.
The grocery store.
Nice try, detective.
Oh, give me a second. I know this.
She checked her watch, waiting.
Tell you what, email me. I really have to get home. Got a long day tomorrow.
She started for the door.
Safeway.
Andy stopped.
What?
That's where my wife buys the groceries.
She smiled thinly.
That's very impressive, Dick.
But to truly be a better man than Gus Wheatley, you have to put your knowledge to use.
What do you mean?
Now that you know where the store is, why don't you go buy the groceries? She gave a friendly wink, then headed out the door. The disguise was simple but effective. A brown wig and mustache. Eyeglasses with a tortoiseshell frame. Tinted contact lenses turned his blue eyes brown. A bulky winter coat with padding underneath made him look a good 30 pounds heavier, well over his normal 185. The leather gloves were completely inconspicuous. By 11 p.m., the temperature had dropped below freezing and a cold wind was blowing off the sound. Only a fool wouldn't bundle up. The Quicksilver Copy Center was open 24 hours a day. It was located next to a pizza place in a strip mall. Any time of day, you could find half a dozen bleary-eyed souls standing at the Xerox machines, and tonight was no exception. As an all-purpose business center, it also offered everything from mailboxes and conference rooms to fax machines and computers by the hour. It was the computers that interested him, specifically anonymous internet access that could never be traced back to him. The bell on the door tinkled as he entered, but no one looked up. He approached the counter and stopped. The clerk, a college-aged woman, was on the telephone. He made no faces, showed no sign of impatience. He simply waited. He would do nothing to make his visit memorable to her or anyone else. Finally, the clerk said goodnight to her boyfriend and hung up the phone.
Can I help you, sir?
I need a computer. He offered a $20 bill, his gloves still on. She took the money, made change from the register.
Pod number 3 is open. Thank you for using Quicksilver.
He scooped the change from the countertop and walked away. Each computer was separated by shoulder-high office dividers, one customer per cubicle. That was all the privacy he needed. He sat at the terminal and removed his leather gloves. As an animal's skin, leather could leave behind distinctive patterns, not unlike fingerprints. He wore flesh-toned rubber gloves beneath the leather, no prints of any kind. His fingers danced across the keyboard as he logged onto the internet. He went to the mail center from which he could send email. He typed in the address which he had memorized. He did not identify the sender. It would read only Quicksilver Copy Center. There was space to type a message, but that too he left blank. He pulled a diskette from his coat pocket and loaded it into the B drive. He uploaded it to the computer and attached it as a file to his blank message. The file contained everything he needed to communicate. It had no words on it, only pictures. Pictures he had taken. A picture was worth a thousand screams. He smirked to himself as he hit the send button, firing off his bloody missive. Chapter 7. Gus was home by 10 o'clock. He paid the babysitter, sent her off in a taxi, and checked on Morgan. She was asleep in her room, which was a relief. He wasn't prepared to answer any more questions about Mommy. He hadn't slept much in the last 2 days, but he wasn't sleepy. He went to the kitchen to fix a sandwich. Sliced ham and baby Swiss were in the refrigerator. He rolled it like a hot dog and stuffed it into a baguette, slathering on some Dijon mustard. Almost as an afterthought, he glanced at the label on the package, just to see where Beth had bought it. Boar's Head was all it said. Could have come from anywhere. He still didn't know where she shopped. He pulled up a stool and sat at the counter alone with his thoughts. Detective Kessler had definitely ticked him off, but maybe he was right. Beth's disappearance didn't automatically add up to foul play. Ego had him jumping to conclusions. It was perversely self-centered, but what man didn't think his wife was more likely to be abducted than to find a worthy replacement? Perhaps he had put too much stock into the fact that she had left without her car, her clothes, even her purse and credit cards. For all he knew, she'd been stockpiling cash for months. She could have bought a whole new wardrobe, rented a red convertible, and driven to Acapulco. Adios, Gus. The question was, would she come back? Of course she would. She was just making him squirm. This was payback time for all those times he'd left her alone with absolutely no idea when he'd be back. Funny, but he could map the decline of his marriage through all those business trips. As a first-year associate, he used to schedule his meetings on a Friday or a Monday so Beth could fly out with him, and they'd spend the weekend in places like Malibu or Monterey. That stopped when Beth tired of hopping on airplanes just to watch her husband work by the swimming pool. Then he started traveling alone, but he would call home every night before bed. That was nice for a while, but it too faded. The more senior he got, the more business he crammed into each trip. Client dinners could last hours. It got to the point that he'd go away for days and be lucky to squeeze in a call from the airport to let her know he was on his way home. Even that became unworkable. Somewhere along the way, he just gave up and left it to his secretary to leave a message telling her where he was. He was comfortable with that. It was his secretary, after all, who had picked out the gifts for birthdays and anniversaries, who sent Beth flowers whenever he had to cancel their plans. Beth got a lot of flowers. A noise from down the hall caught his attention. He was suddenly alert, listening. He heard it again, more clearly this time.
Mommy!
It was coming from Morgan's room. His pulse quickened. Was she back?
Mommy!
The cry was desperate. Now what do I do? He slid off the stool and started down the hall. The calls grew louder, separated by brief, pathetic pauses.
Mom? Mommy?
Gus drew a deep breath and opened the door. A crack of light from the hallway cut across the bedroom. Morgan was sitting up against the headboard. She was wearing pink Minnie Mouse pajamas. It was amazing how skinny and fragile a kid could look in those clingy cotton pajamas.
He went and sat at the edge of the bed.
It's okay. Daddy's here.
Her voice quaked.
Where's Mommy?
She's not here, sweetheart.
Where is she?
She's... Gus had no clue, but he had sense enough not to scare her. Mommy had something she had to take care of.
When is she coming back?
Soon, I think. It should be soon.
Can we call her?
No, not tonight.
Tomorrow?
We'll see. She was plainly skeptical. In the dim shadow of a Winnie the Pooh nightlight, Gus felt grilled. Just 10 seconds of punishing silence had given him a whole new insight into the shrewdness of an only child who spent more time around adults than other children. 6 years of training from a no-nonsense nanny who'd seen every trick in the book hadn't hurt either. Morgan asked,
"Where did she go?"
"That's her secret. She didn't say."
"Why didn't she take me with her?"
His throat tightened. "It's just something she had to do by herself, sweetheart, that's all. Sometimes parents have to do things by themselves." She didn't look satisfied. Gus moved closer, urging her toward the pillow. "Let's go back to sleep now." She leaned back obediently. Gus sensed the stiffness in her body, the unresolved fears. He stroked her forehead gently. "Just close your eyes and go to sleep." Her eyes closed, but the lids quivered. He wondered what she was thinking. She sure asked smart questions. She could probably handle a witness better than half the so-called trial lawyers at his law firm. One question in particular stuck in his brain, the one Morgan had struggled to ask, the one Gus had found most difficult to answer. If Beth had just decided to leave him, if she'd really wanted to get his attention, why didn't she take Morgan with her? He remained at her side and watched her fall asleep, searching for an answer that didn't seem to be there. Andy went straight home from the morgue, thinking. Gus hadn't really given them sufficient details to test her bookend homicide theory. Still, she didn't buy Kessler's idea that Gus was being intentionally evasive. For whatever reason, he and his wife had simply become strangers while living under the same roof. Somehow that seemed almost as sad as her disappearance. Andy was in bed by 11:30, but the night would be a restless one. She was definitely nervous about meeting Victoria Santos at the airport. She set 2 alarms just to make sure she didn't oversleep, assuming she ever fell asleep. Her eyes were wide open, staring at the ceiling. The bed felt different these days. Although Rick had never officially moved in, they'd spent nearly every night together for several months before the wedding. It didn't matter that she owned one of those expensive coil mattresses on which you could drop a bowling ball and not disturb your mate, when you're used to sleeping with someone you know when you're alone. By midnight, her thoughts had turned from Rick to Gus, then to Gus's wife. It was certainly possible that something horrible had happened to her. But she couldn't dismiss another possibility. She knew the pain of almost marrying a man who didn't truly love her. She could only imagine what a woman might do after a wasted decade of living with her mistake. Sure, Andy had experienced more than her share of lonely Saturday nights, but nothing was worse than feeling alone when you weren't. The alarm buzzed, but she woke unrested, unable to distinguish her dreams from the things she had lain awake worrying about. She was dressed and ready to go by the time Tuesday's early edition of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer landed on the doorstep. She stepped right over it on her way out the door, but the blazing headline practically reached out and tripped her. Serial killer leaves third victim. Beneath it, in smaller typeset, may be killing in pairs. Andy tore open the paper and devoured the lead article. She finished with a 2-word summary of her own, uttered aloud. Oh, shit. Victoria Santos was scheduled to arrive at SeaTac Airport in 35 minutes, so she jumped in the car and then dialed Isaac Underwood at home on her cellular phone. She knew he was an early riser, probably staring at the paper and choking on his cornflakes right about now.
Isaac, hey, it's Andy. Seen this morning's PI yet?
Just did. Not one of your better moves, Andy.
Isaac, I swear, I don't know how it hit the papers. All that stuff about bookends, I just came up with that last night. I haven't told anyone but Kessler. I would never leak without prior approval from a supervisor.
I believe you. The problem is, it looks like you did an end run on an ISU profiler. That isn't going to sit well with Victoria Santos. Yesterday she had a clean slate. Now you got her boxed inside a theory she may think is silly.
What should I do?
First, don't freak. Second, check the mirror every now and then. If you find your face turning blue, remind yourself, breathe.
I'm serious. I'm meeting Santos in less than an hour.
You want me to talk to her?
No. It's my mess. I'll fix it.
That's what I thought you'd say. I know you're short on time, but it would help if you could get a handle on how this leaked.
I'll call Kessler.
Good. But be careful with him.
How do you mean?
I get along fine with him, but not everybody does. Back in my days with the department, people used to say he's perfectly balanced, got a chip on both shoulders.
Now you tell me.
Hey, if anybody can dust off his shoulders, it's you.
Thanks, boss, she said, then hung up.
Morning traffic on the interstate was getting heavier by the minute. With one eye on the road, she dug Kessler's business card out of her purse and dialed him at home. His wife answered and said he was in the shower.
Can you get him, please? This is extremely important.
Andy cut off a van as she veered toward the airport exit. Finally, Kessler came to the phone.
Hello?
He said, a bit like a bumpkin.
Dick, I don't mean any level of accusations, but how did the sum and substance of our conversation last night in the autopsy room make it into this morning's newspaper?
I called them.
Without telling me?
I'm a firm believer in using the media to help solve crimes. Victoria Santos is, too. I've heard her lectures.
I don't argue with the concept, said Andy. But floating an untested theory might just put ideas in some wacko's head and make it come true. Hell, even you didn't buy the theory when I first suggested it.
The more I thought about it, the more sense it made.
We should have at least run it by Agent Santos.
It's too damn late for that now. FBI politics is your problem, not mine.
That's true, said Andy. I was just hoping we could all get off to a little better start than this.
You should have thought of that before you started making smart-ass remarks about who does the grocery shopping in my family.
Come on, Dick. Let's not get petty, all right?
I'm not being petty. I'm actually doing you a favor. This press leak gives you the perfect opportunity to find out right from the get-go whether the rumors are true.
What rumors?
From what I hear, Santos has one trait that overshadows even her brilliance.
Her patience? Andy said hopefully.
Her ego. Best of luck, kid. Call me when Her Royal Majesty is ready to meet.
Andy tossed the phone into the passenger seat and checked herself in the rearview mirror.
Breathe, she said, as she approached the airport.
Chapter 8. Morgan was dressed in her plaid jumper and knee socks, ready for school, asleep on the couch in Gus's office. Gus had gotten her up much earlier than usual, dressed her in her elementary school uniform, and taken her to work with him. She'd been out cold since they'd arrived downtown more than 2 hours ago, before dawn. He had managed not to wake her as he held her in the elevator and carried her to the couch. She didn't have to be at school till 9, but he had to be at the office before 7. He arrived on time, sleepy kid in tow. At 8:15, the eyes blinked open and she began to stir. Gus looked up from the paperwork spread across his desk. He had never watched Morgan wake before. At least not the whole adorable process. It was such a contrast to the adult world of buzzing jolts from alarm clocks. He thought of those time-released films of flowers in bloom. She yawned like a bear cub shaking off hibernation, fending off the sunlight streaming through the east window of the big corner office. She slid off the couch and went straight to the window, struck by the view from the 49th floor.
Wow! This is like the Space Needle.
Her nose was pressed against the glass as she gazed towards snow-capped Mount Rainier. Gus smiled wanly, then shrank inside. 6 years old, and Morgan had never been to her father's office.
No wonder you live here.
The window fogged as she spoke into it. This is just an office, sweetheart. Daddy doesn't live here.
Mommy says you do.
The words cut to the core. No point debating it. Morgan stepped away from the window. The colorful collection of carved wooden horses on the end table had caught her attention. She took one. Gus jumped up before she could grab the others.
Those aren't toys, honey. They look like toys.
That's because they were once, but now they're antiques. Expensive antiques. He took the carved thoroughbred and put it back on the table by the others.
Are you going to take me to school today?
Sort of. A young man appeared in the open doorway.
Ready, Mr. Wheatley?
Morgan glanced up as if to ask,
Who's that?
Gus got down on one knee so they could speak eye to eye. Morgan, this is Jeremy. He's very nice. He works in the mailroom. He's going to take Daddy's car and drive you to school.
Why don't you take me?
I can't, not today.
Why can't Mommy take me?
It's like I said last night. Mommy is taking some time away. She frowned.
Will she pick me up?
I don't know. We'll see. Morgan lowered her head in silence. Gus wasn't sure if he should say something, maybe give her a hug. He rose and gave Jeremy the car keys. She goes to Birchie.
To what?
Jeremy wasn't the kind of kid who'd know the way to a grade school with a 5-figure annual tuition. Gus quickly sketched a map on his legal pad. It's on 10th Avenue. Easy to find. Drive carefully and be sure she rides in the back seat.
No problem.
Morgan was still visibly upset. With one finger, Gus lifted her chin from her chest. Hey, no long faces, okay? I promise if your mother doesn't pick you up this afternoon, I'll pick you up myself. Is that a deal? She clutched her nylon book bag, saying nothing. He gave her a kiss on the cheek. Can Daddy have a hug? Her arms never left her side. He hugged her anyway, but she didn't hug back. He rose, somewhat embarrassed, in front of Jeremy. You better get going. She has to be there by 9. Jeremy guided Morgan to the door. Gus watched as they passed the secretarial pod outside his office and started down the hall. Instinct told him to act normal around Morgan until he heard from the police, not to say anything that might scare her. Problem was, he had very little sense of what was normal between him and Morgan. He closed the door and started back toward his desk. He stopped in mid-step. The end table caught his attention, his collection of antique horses. One of them was missing, the one Morgan had been playing with. He checked first under the table. Nothing. He searched the couch where she'd been sitting, shoving his hand between all the seat cushions. A couple of pens emerged, a lost nickel, but no carved horse. He glanced out the window, focusing on the waist-high palm prints Morgan had left on the glass. An unsettling feeling slowly washed over him, but the conclusion was inescapable. His own daughter had just shoplifted. Andy entered the main terminal for the American Airlines entrance. The sun had yet to rise, but the airport was bustling. The hour before dawn was like yin and yang at SeaTac. Half the people were full of energy, hurrying toward flights that marked the start of their day. The other half were like zombies, arriving from some faraway place after a long night of travel. Andy was somewhere between the extremes, excited about her new assignment, yet sickened by the shaky start. She hadn't decided exactly what to tell Victoria Santos about the press leak, but she had to think of something fast. Throughout the terminal, it seemed like every 50 feet there was another newsstand blasting the premature headlines about a serial killer. She tucked a copy of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer under her arm and moved with the crowd toward the baggage carousels. At the turnstile, she stopped short. Just ahead was Victoria Santos.
She was dressed comfortably for the long flight, slacks and a sweater, but Andy recognized her instantly. Santos was a bit of an FBI legend, especially among female agents. Years ago, she had made a name for herself with the Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit. It was her profiling and hard work that had cracked the famous Tongue Murder case, a nationwide string of bizarre murders that were connected only by the killer's gruesome signature, the extraction of each victim's tongue. It was the first of many success stories. She was well established as a supervisory special agent by the time Andy had met her, for the first and only time, at a training course Santos taught at the academy. She was slightly taller than Andy, with eyes every bit as intense as Andy had remembered. Up until a month ago, her long, dark hair had been one of her more striking features. Rumor had it that she'd cut it to shoulder length on her 45th birthday. That she hadn't gone to some expensive hairstylist, just grabbed the scissors from her desk drawer and whacked it off. It was no secret that criminal profilers had one of the highest burnout rates in the Bureau. Some said Victoria was approaching the point in her career where she'd crawled inside the head of too many psychopaths, that she looked into the eyes of too many lifeless victims. Others thought she was still steaming over the inexplicable decision to derail her promotion to unit chief at Casco by transferring her to the investigative support unit. Her supporters said she was extremely aggressive. Her detractors said she was extremely aggressive. Bureau politics being what they were, you didn't have to be the highest-ranking woman in a predominantly male unit to get stabbed in the back.
Miss Santos? Andy extended her hand. I'm Agent Henning. It's a pleasure to meet you. Actually, it's an honor.
Andy cringed at the honor a bit, concerned that she was sounding like a kiss-ass.
I hope you're not too honored to call me Victoria, she said as they shook hands. Okay, Victoria.
They exchanged smiles, but Victoria looked understandably tired. She had just flown coast to coast on the red-eye, having left her home in Virginia sometime after midnight. Andy glanced at the two bags at her side.
I see you already got your luggage.
Yeah, let's get out of here.
Andy and Victoria reached for the same suitcase at the same instant. They knocked heads. Andy backed away, startled. The rolled-up copy of the Post-Intelligencer slid from under her arm and fell to the floor. The page one story was right at their feet. Victoria rubbed her forehead where Andy had butted her. She did a double take at the catchy headline, then picked up the paper and gave it a quick read.
A serial killer slaying in pairs? Where did this come from?
Andy cringed as she replied.
It's a theory. Whose theory?
Mine, she said, shrinking.
What's it doing in the newspaper?
The local police leaked it. She glowered. I'd better read this, she said as she snapped open the newspaper.
I think so, too, Andy said.
Victoria walked as she read. Andy followed behind, toting her bags. Andy said not a word all the way to the car, just trying to gauge Victoria's reaction to the article. Victoria opened the passenger door and got in. Andy tossed the bags in the back seat, got behind the wheel, and drove out of the garage. Victoria folded the newspaper and laid it on the dashboard. Andy was bracing herself for a shakedown, but Victoria simply popped open her briefcase and buried her nose in a notepad as Andy maneuvered out of the airport. For 10 minutes, Andy endured the silent treatment. Finally, she couldn't take it anymore.
Excuse me, but aren't you going to say anything?
Victoria glanced up from her notes.
I'm not going to chew you out, Andy. What's done is done. But if you're looking for me to say everything's okay, it's not.
I wasn't trying to upstage you or impress you. I wasn't trying to impress anyone. It was just a theory.
And I'm not saying your theory is necessarily a bad one. The real damage is that once any theory hits the press and gets ingrained in the heads of the local police, it's hard to get them to come off it. Makes my job a lot harder than it needs to be.
But I wasn't the one who leaked it. It was a detective named Kessler.
That's no excuse. It's your job as coordinator to gain the respect of the locals. If you have their respect, 9 times out of 10 they'll listen to you if you ask them to keep something out of the press.
Andy felt a pang in her gut, realizing she'd never expressly asked Kessler to keep the theory out of the papers.
You're right. For that, I apologize.
Again, there was only silence. Andy said, I don't mean to be pushy, but it would make me feel a lot better if you were to say something. Like, apology accepted. Andy kept her eyes on the road, waiting for a reply. Finally, she glanced over and caught Victoria's eye. It wasn't the disapproving glare Andy had expected. Quite the opposite. It was as if Victoria had warmed to her fight.
Apology accepted, Victoria said. And don't worry about it. Happens to all of us.
Andy was only half relieved.
Somehow I don't think anything like this ever happened to you. Actually, it did.
Serious?
Long time ago. My first year in Quantico. We had a geographically transient serial killer. The only lead was an anonymous newspaper informant who had an uncanny ability to predict each murder, time, place, victim. My unit chief was convinced the informant was himself the killer. I wasn't. I went over his head, straight to the assistant director of the criminal division, laid my reputation on the line.
How did your unit chief feel about that?
About the way you'd expect. He was madder than hell.
How did you smooth things out?
Sometimes things have a way of smoothing themselves out.
How do you mean?
It's simple, really. Now that your theory is printed in black and white all over Seattle, you just have to hope for one thing.
What?
That you're right.
Andy started to smile, then realized that Victoria wasn't kidding. She cranked up the heater and merged into rush hour on the crowded interstate. Chapter 9. Gus went back to work after Morgan left, but he couldn't focus on the documents spread across the leather desktop. At 11 a.m., he and three of his department heads were scheduled to pitch their services to a Japanese manufacturer seeking Seattle counsel. Beauty pageants, lawyers call them, where every major law firm in the city trots out its finest lawyers to win the hearts and wallets of major corporations. The analogy had its limits. In Gus's experience, not a single contestant had ever vowed to feed starving children or promote world peace, and never did the runners-up smile and congratulate the winner. This morning, his thoughts were entirely on Beth, swinging from one troubling extreme to the other. One minute he was sure she was safe, but had left him. The next, he imagined she was dead. The shoplifting incident had only confused him further. Morgan probably sensed something was wrong and was acting out for attention. Or perhaps it was a symptom of long-standing psychological problems of which Gus had been unaware till now. Maybe even Beth had blamed herself, saw herself as a failure, and in a moment of weakness had run away in despair. Whatever the answer, Gus needed to prepare himself better to deal with Morgan. He could call on professionals for guidance, but it was never his practice to consult anyone cold. Surely there were articles on the internet about the psychological effects on children who had lost a parent. He pulled up his chair and switched on the computer. The screen brightened and prompted a message. Your password is about to expire. Please enter a new code. For security reasons, the firm required its attorneys to change passwords every 90 days. Gus tried to conjure up a new 4-digit number. He usually used dates. The date he was graduated from Stanford. The day he was elected managing partner. This morning, however, he was feeling a little sentimental. He started to type in his wedding anniversary. He entered the month, 09, then drew a blank on the exact day. It was either the 14th or 15th of September. He wasn't sure. It was definitely a Saturday. Of course it was a Saturday, you idiot. A reprieve came with a knock on the door. It opened before he could say, come in, which meant it was either the President of the United States or Martha.
Need a friend?
It wasn't the chief executive. Come on in. Martha had the look of a concerned friend, entering quietly and closing the door behind her. She sat on the edge of the couch, anxious.
Any word on Beth?
Just a waiting game now. Police don't really seem to know anything. I'm just trying to stay focused.
I think that's wise.
I wouldn't read too much into what the papers say.
Papers? What do you mean?
You haven't seen this morning's PI?
No, I've been so busy I didn't even have time to check. Is there something about Beth?
I'm sorry. Don't be alarmed.
What is it?
He said with urgency. They don't mention her by name. It's just a story about a possible serial killer who is killing his victims in matching pairs. Two men were the first victims. Now they found a woman. They don't come out and say it, but from the physical description, it sounds like Beth.
I was at the morgue last night. They asked me to view a woman's body. It wasn't Beth.
It must be the unidentified woman they mentioned in the article.
And now they think what? That Beth is her match?
Her bookend is the term they use.
He was suddenly alarmed. Now that you mention that, there was a slight physical resemblance.
I'm not trying to scare you, Gus. The police don't come out and say anything about Beth directly. That was my inference. All the article says is that they have two male victims, both strangled, both a lot like each other, very similar crime scenes. Now they have a female victim, also strangled. What they don't have is a second female victim. Only fear is that the killer might strike another woman who resembles her.
Who might be Beth.
Gus snatched up the phone and buzzed his secretary, calling for a copy of today's paper. In a matter of seconds, she entered, dropped it on his desk, and left without a peep. Gus devoured the lead story in silence. Finally, he lowered the paper and looked at Martha.
I can't believe this. I was just with the FBI last night. They never said a word to me about a serial killer.
That's probably because they don't think Beth is a bookend.
How can you read this article and say that?
Because I don't think Beth is a bookend either.
So you think all this talk of a serial killer is what, premature speculation?
I didn't say that. There may be a serial killer in Seattle. He may be killing in pairs. I just don't think Beth is one of his victims.
And on what crackerjack investigative expertise do you base that opinion?
She hesitated, then answered, I'm sorry, but if anyone was to ask me, I'd say Beth probably left you.
He leaned forward. Have you talked to her?
No.
Do you know something I don't know?
Just call it gut instinct.
Instinct? His voice had a dubious tone.
More than that, really. It's an opinion based on observation. You and Beth have a history that can't be ignored. It wasn't that long ago that she accused you of spouse abuse.
That was over 5 years ago.
Whatever, a woman doesn't make false accusations without some agenda. With Beth, I think it was a classic case of a wife crying out for her husband's attention.
Gus moved nervously in his chair. Their marriage counselor had said the same thing. The accusations weren't malicious, they were an act of desperation.
What's your point?
Obviously, she couldn't make you listen, so she finally left you.
That's so simplistic.
Maybe. But I'm one of those people who tends to think the simplest answer is often the right answer.
Sure, it's wise to consider all the possibilities. Based on what I've heard this morning at the water cooler, people have already written Beth off as victim number 4 of this serial killer. But for me, it's clear. Beth is fine, wherever she decided to go.
She wouldn't just leave without Morgan.
Maybe she'll come back for her.
Are you trying to make me feel better or worse? I'm not trying to make you anything. I just want you to know all the facts.
She looked him in the eye, her tone softening.
I never told you this before. I never told anyone this before. The last time I saw Beth was at the firm holiday party. I'll never forget the way she looked at me. Death rays all night.
For what?
For being the other woman.
Other woman? He scoffed. Hold on there, Martha. This may come as news to you, but as far as I'm aware, you and I have never had sex.
There are other levels of marital infidelity.
What are you talking about?
Intimacy. It's not just a physical thing. It's a matter of who you make time to talk to every day. Who you call first to share good news. Who you turn to for advice. Who helps you solve your problems. True, we've never seen each other naked, but on every other level, I understand you better than your own wife. In every room but the bedroom, I'm the woman you would rather be with. Two people don't have to jump in the sack to be soulmates. He smiled awkwardly.
Martha, I like you. I like you a lot, but we're a far cry from soulmates.
She looked sad for a split second, then angry.
Come on, he said. We're not soulmates.
Fine. If labels make you uncomfortable, drop it. But you don't have to insult me by acting like it's the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard.
Oh, please, don't get thin-skinned on me now.
She checked her watch, rising. I better go, before you really say something you regret.
What's that supposed to mean?
I've always stood by you. When Beth accused you of abuse, the executive committee was primed to dump you from the partnership before the story hit the papers and tarnished the firm's image. Some people saw it as an opportunity for a change in firm leadership. They saw you as vulnerable.
What does that have to do with anything?
Quite possibly nothing. But if it turns out Beth finally did walk out on you, don't be surprised if the rumbling starts all over again.
People will think what they want to think.
She leaned forward, her palms resting on the edge of his desk, as she looked him straight in the eye. All I'm saying is be careful. Now more than ever, you can't afford to lose friends. She turned and headed out, letting the door close behind her.
Gus took a deep breath. He'd seen her angry before, furious, in fact. This was different. He wasn't quite sure how to handle it. All he knew was that he didn't need another problem to solve.
He faced his computer.
The cursor was blinking on the screen, still asking him to enter a new password, still waiting on his wedding anniversary date. He searched his memory, but the date didn't come. In his mind, he heard Martha, his self-proclaimed soulmate, expounding on her own brand of marital infidelity. A tightness gripped his chest. For all his marital problems, the one thing he'd clung to was that he had never cheated on Beth. He never would. For the moment, however, he felt as though he had. He stared blankly at the screen, trying to remember the anniversary. It was hopeless. In a flurry of frustration, he entered a new 4-digit password. It was the date Beth had disappeared. Andy drove Victoria straight from the airport to the downtown police station. She had been invited by the locals, so it was only logical that the FBI would meet on their turf. They entered through the main entrance on 9th Street. Andy shook the rain from her umbrella onto the green tile floor. A pair of detectives hurried in right behind them, their trench coats soaked from the cold morning drizzle. Cops in blue uniforms crisscrossed the lobby. A half-dozen suspects were handcuffed and waiting on a bench along the far wall. The oldest one was an aging relic of the 60s with long, stringy gray hair. He had dried vomit on his shoes and an annoying determination to sing Sonny and Cher's "I Got You, Babe" to the female officer who had dragged him in for disorderly conduct. Amazingly, his screeching voice was nearly drowned out by the general noise and commotion echoing off the high ceilings. With a quick check of her watch, Andy realized the station was buzzing with the early morning change of the guard. It was easy to tell who was coming and who was going. There was no face more telling than that of a cop coming off the midnight to 8 shift. Victoria went straight to the duty officer to announce their arrival. Andy's beeper chirped. She recognized the number. Gus had given her his private line last night.
"We're a few minutes early," she said to Victoria. "I'd like to return this call."
"Sure, go ahead."
"Thanks."
She went down the hall to a payphone and dialed. She pressed the receiver tightly to her ear and put a finger to the other, blocking out the noise from the lobby.
"Gus," she said into the phone, "it's Andy Henning. You paged me?"
"Why did I have to read about this serial killer in the newspaper?"
Her heart sank. All morning long, she'd been worried about Victoria's reaction. That paled in comparison to the way Gus's voice made her feel.
"I'm sorry this happened."
Sorry it leaked, or sorry my wife is dead.
No one said your wife is dead. The bookend theory is just that, a theory.
Why didn't you tell me last night?
Because it's very preliminary.
Not too preliminary to make front page news?
Believe me, I was just as surprised as you were to read about this in the paper.
Excuse me?
I never intended that theory to hit the newspapers.
He scoffed. That's reassuring. Sounds like you've really got things under control.
Andy struggled. At this point, it seemed the more she told him, the deeper she dug her hole. I wish I had time to explain, but I don't right now.
Explain this much for me, will you please?
I'm still curious as to why the FBI even has a hand in this. I'm not a criminal lawyer, but homicide isn't normally a federal crime.
Do you think Beth was kidnapped and taken across state lines? Is that why the FBI is involved?
No, the FBI is involved only to support local law enforcement.
What does that mean?
You really want to know?
My wife is missing. I have a right to know.
Andy couldn't argue. A few details might help put him at ease. She glanced back toward the lobby. Victoria was waiting.
I have to make this fast, she said into the phone. One of our agents from the investigative support unit arrived this morning. She and I will meet with the local homicide detectives.
To do what?
First off, we'll try to determine whether we even have a serial killer.
Then what?
If we think we do, we'll probably take steps toward organizing a multi-jurisdictional task force.
Led by the FBI?
Not exactly. It can get complicated, the more agencies that are involved. The best way to sum up the arrangement is to say things generally don't work the way you see them on television. The FBI doesn't conduct the investigation. That's the job of local law enforcement. We help organize things and make sure the locals get the services they need. Crime analysis, formulation of investigative strategies, technical and forensic resource coordination, use of the FBI evidence response teams or FBI laboratory services. Our experts will also review the evidence to construct a psychological profile of who the killer might be. It helps police sharpen their investigation, helps them zero in on certain types of people. It basically gives them somebody to look for when they don't know who they should be looking for.
So, who are you looking for?
There's no profile yet. That takes a little time.
These profiles, you can tell a lot about the killer from them, right?
They get fairly detailed, yes. She glanced again toward the lobby. Victoria was pacing. I'm sorry, Gus, I really have to go.
Wait, there's one thing I'm particularly interested in.
What?
In this profiling stuff. Is there any way to know if the killer keeps his victims alive? For a while, I mean?
I told you we don't have a profile yet.
I'm asking you.
His voice was loud, desperate.
I need some information. Just something to go on, okay? If there is a serial killer, and he does have Beth, how much time have we got?
I wish I could answer. There's just no way to say for sure.
There must be some rough estimate you can give me.
Guessing wouldn't be productive.
Then, damn it, give me the facts. You have 3 victims so far. How long was it from the time the victims disappeared until the estimated time of death?
We don't know on the woman. We don't even have an ID yet, so we can't say how long she was missing before she died.
What about the men?
She hesitated, fearful of the inference Gus might draw.
The crime scene was the death scene.